Chapter 6. The Man Sri Maharshi. Maharshi was born on 31st December 1879 in a village near Madura in South India. He was named Venkatraman. He belonged to a respected but not affluent Brahmin family, his father being a pleader. He and his elder brother were educated at a local high school. Up to that time, there was nothing to make anyone suspect that a spiritual genius was here in embryo. Venkatraman was a beautiful, healthy boy, loving sports and physical exercise, but not overly keen on study. There was a legend in his family that from every generation, one of his sons would leave home and discard the worldly life. The only spiritual book that had made an impression on the boy was the Periyar Puranam, which describes the lives of 63 Shaivite saints. Maharshi later said that when he read it, a strange desire arose in him, a yearning to be one of those saints. Finally, when listening to a relative speaking about his pilgrimage to Arunachal, a holy hill some 100 miles from Madura, the very word Arunachala struck a responsive chord in the heart of the youth. He asked his relative to explain about this Mount Arunachal. Sometime later, he had an extraordinary experience. Suddenly, while alone in his room, a terrible fear of realization of death overcame him. The young Venkatraman, in perfect health and without any outward suffering, felt that his last hour had come. His reaction was entirely different from what one would expect. He called for no help, nor did he seek a doctor, but quietly lay down on the floor, saying to himself, "Death is coming to me. But death of what? My body is already lying without movement. It is becoming cold and stiff, but I, my consciousness, is not affected at all. I am, therefore, independent of this dying form. I am not this body." After some time, life came back to the corpse-like body, but its dweller was changed. His experience brought him the conviction of the independence of his real self from the temporary form falsely called I. Shortly after this, he left Madura, giving no indication of his destination, leaving only a note for his family asking them not to worry and not to seek him, as he assured them he was embarking on a virtuous enterprise. Taking only enough money to pay part of his fare, he travelled by train and on foot to Tirunmalai, the nearest township to Mount Arunachal. He then stayed at the numerous temples and shrines in the neighbourhood, cutting his hair and discarding his Brahmin clothes as a sign of renunciation of the world. Nobody knew him. He sat for days unconscious of his body, immersed in deep samadhi, and at first the new spiritual awakening brought complete neglect of his outer personality. Hungry and emaciated, eating only the scraps of food brought to him by visitors who took pity on the young ascetic and speaking no word in his observance of the silence, mauna, the future great Rishi spent long years of extremely strenuous life at the foot of the sacred Arunachala. The fame of the boy grew. Now food was offered to him in plenty, but he took only what was needed to keep alight the flame of his physical life. His spirituality was such that no one of any perception could come near him without recognizing his unique quality. Then came the first disciple in the persons of various swamis and devotees. In those years of complete silence, he left us his first written teaching, addressed to some faithful attendants who wanted to have his instructions. In extremely concentrated form, the young sage gave his teaching to the world in two small books entitled Who Am I? And Spiritual Instructions. In the meantime, his mother and his elder brother found him and begged him to return home. He refused. But it seems, when his mother lost the house where he was born and had no one to support her aging years, he agreed to her living at the ashram. She looked after the cooking for him, his attendants and visitors, and became his pupil. Under his guidance, it is believed that she attained liberation. A new period of life began for the sage. From near and far came pilgrims and devotees who had heard of the unique spirituality of Maharshi. The name was first bestowed on him by a learned Pandit, Ganapati Shastri, who sat at his feet, plying him with questions. From the answers given, it was recognized that the young Swami was of the highest rank, known in India as great rishis or seers. After the publication of a book by Narasimha Swami about the life and teaching of Maharshi, and after a search in secret India by Paul Brunton appeared in London, an uninterrupted flow of visitors from all over the world began. Talks with him by pilgrims from all over the country and his answers to their problems became famous. Eminent intellectuals from the West also sat at his feet, and some of their reminiscences have appeared in the Golden Jubilee souvenir, published on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of his arrival at Arunachala. His brother had taken over the management of the ashram's affairs, administering them with great ability, but Maharshi never cared for the temporal and eversent things. All his earthly possessions were a bamboo stick, a wooden bowl of water, kamandalu, and a loincloth. Besides the previously mentioned two small books, Maharshi wrote some hymns with commentaries in Sanskrit, Tamil, and Telugu. These have been translated into English, some with forewords by eminent English writers. Throughout his life, the great Rishi was always accessible to any visitor. In his presence, no distinction was given to caste, so rigidly followed in India. Brahmins sat with Harijans, Muslims and Westerners. The visible presence of the spirit in man united the troubled world at his feet. He was supreme, far above all levels of human understanding. That intangible atmosphere of spiritual peace dissolved all doubts in his presence. The writer came to him in the very last period of his earthly life and believes this to be the most glorious period of all. As the sun sinks in the blaze of sunset glory, so Maharshi's last tears reflected the indescribable beauty of his manifestation. I saw the man as he showed the victory of spirit over matter. His physical suffering, lasting for more than a year, was a crucifixion in my eyes. For him, there was no alleviation in a hospital, although his sickness was deadly. He always gave the permanent darshan for our sake. He always sat before us, and no movement or complaint ever showed the depth of his suffering. He wanted no cure. Knowing all that could be expected of his body, his thought was always for us, who went to him to seek relief from our own sufferings, and to none did he refuse his blessing. His spiritual alchemy transmuted the hard materialism of our hearts into something pure and noble. In the glory of his presence, we learn to live in eternity, to remember our lost inheritance of spirit and bliss. Sometimes when I sat near him, absorbing the invisible radiation of his light, I meditated. To whom and when can I repay this bliss? Who is it that is taking away the burdens and debts of my life? He has no sin, has never performed an evil deed. But what is there about me, about all of us who are gathered together at his feet, seeking solace and power to endure our petty discomforts? His body, which has committed no sin, is suffering agony in our presence. We are healthy in spite of our guilt. End of quote. The mysterious voice asks, quote, are you ready to accept the responsibility for that? The soundless answer is, yes, if you will always be with me. And the conviction arises within that he is and will be forever.